I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Half a century ago, in August 1970, I went to the Philadelphia Folk Festival with my then boyfriend, and the most memorable concert that weekend was Fairport Convention, a folk rock group from England that blew us all away. The music, the musicianship, the energy, the voices got us off our seats and dancing with wild abandon. Our guest, Richard Thompson, a founder of Fairport Convention, covers that hot and humid day in his memoir, Beeswing, about looking out at the crowd and writing, quote, "At last we found our target American audience." Beeswing, also the title of one of his songs, is about growing up in post-war England, discovering his passion for guitars and Sufism, and his early years as a musician from 1967 to 1975, marked by both success and tragedy. Richard Thompson lives in New Jersey now and joins us by Skype on Radio Times. A great pleasure. Richard Thompson, nice to have you with us on the show today.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
What is it like to get that kind of a reaction from an audience? Your book took me back to that really memorable concert, you know, 51 years ago.
Well, this was our first American tour, and we had a very good reaction in the UK prior to that, especially with the dance music that we were playing, you know, the kind of electrified jigs and reels, you know, electrified traditional music. But when we toured America, we thought the reaction was a bit lukewarm, and we couldn't quite figure out if it was just that, like the drugs that were kind of slowing people down. You know, playing at the Fillmore, east of the Fillmore west, you know, a bit of a sort of stoned reaction. But people said, you know, Philadelphia is a great folk town. That's the place you should go. And then we got an offer to play at the Philadelphia Folk Festival, and you know, we absolutely stormed it. The entire audience of however many, is it 10,000 there?
I can't remember.
But everybody was dancing. The entire audience was dancing. And that was extremely reassuring. And thought, okay, now we know who our audience is.
Well, I appreciate that story. You know, writing a memoir, you have to dig through some of that memory bank that we all have. But you begin your book by talking about just the difficulty of looking back and the kind of dust that has covered, the layers of dust that have covered a lot of your memories. Why did you want to write a memoir?
A lot of people ask me about the 1960s, you know, and into the 1970s. And it seems to have been a very important decade. And I think it still resonates these days. I mean, all these years later, still people are listening to, you know, The Dark Side of the Moon and listening to their Led Zeppelin records. It hasn't gone away in many ways, you know, and these people are now legends, you know, people that we were rubbing shoulders with back in the 60s developed this legendary status. So I thought I just wanted to write about that particular time period. And also I wanted to see if I could write something longer than a 3-minute song, you know,
see if I had
the discipline to write a longer piece, you know.
So what was that like for you to go beyond that 3-minute song in writing?
Well, it was actually very enjoyable. I enjoyed the kind of the anecdotal stage, you know, where I'm just basically telling stories. And the difficulty for me was putting stuff into a chronological order, which, of course, are what one's editors love to see. I really had to refer to, you know, there's websites that have, you know, every tour date by Fairport Convention from 1967. So I had to really struggle, you know, actually to put it into some kind of logical sequence.
You were born in 1949. This is England, you know, post-war England. But as you write, you know, there were vestiges of the bombing all around where you were growing up.
Yeah, I don't think London recovered from World War II, you know, probably until the 1970s. And the street I grew up in was half missing. There was a big bomb site at the end of the road where we kids used to love to frolic, you know, among all the you know, the bricks and the broken glass. That was not uncommon in London in those days. And it took until certainly the 60s, probably the 70s, before all those sites were really redeveloped,
wow.
Usually in a disastrously ugly way. But that's another story.
Sure. And talk about dust. I mean, you do. And I think people that were, I was born in 1949 myself. And I think, you know, young people kind of forget that there were these terrible smogs that would sort of roll into cities and just sit there. And you write about that.
I do. Well, you know, London was famous for its smogs, actually. You know, you find it all the time in, you know, Sherlock Holmes novels and in Charles Dickens as well.
That's, you know, 19th century, though, right?
Yeah, but you know, that was because there were so many people, you know, probably millions of people burning coal fires, and that didn't really go away. And in the 1950s, you also had that, you know, big coal burning power stations. You had steam trains, all contributing to this really unbreathable air. As kids, we thought it was just great fun, but because you couldn't see your way to school, so how great is that? but it was obviously very unhealthy, and lots of people were dying of bronchitis in those days. So, you know, they slowly cleaned it up, but for kids, it was just great fun.
What kind of music did you? Your dad was had a great record collection. What kind of music did you grow up listening to?
Well, I grew up listening to my dad's music and my big sister's music, which were quite different. My dad had some good jazz records in among the you know, the more boring kind of show tunes and stuff. So he had Django Reinhardt records, and he had Les Paul records because he was a kind of a amateur guitar player. And he had Duke Ellington, he had Louis Armstrong, you know, which is all wonderful stuff. So I grew up listening to that from a very small age. And then my sister, who was 5 years my senior, was listening to the rock and roll stuff. Was listening to lots of Buddy Holly. She's a huge Buddy Holly fan. You know, Elvis and you know, Gene Vincent, all that kind of stuff. Jerry Lee Lewis. So you know, I had that coming through the bedroom wall from my sister's room. So that was an interesting diet. Plus, you know, my father was Scottish, so we had lots of Scottish dance music in the mix as well.
In fact, you write about your grandmother, your grandmom. She was from the Isle of Skye, and you know, would sing some of the music of that place.
Yeah, you know, she wasn't much of a singer, but you know, she'd just sing around the house, and to me that was kind of fascinating, you know. And I asked her once, you know, to teach me some Gaelic, you know, and she said, "Sure, sir." So I said, "Okay, yeah, sure, sir." "No, no, 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 sure, sir. Sure, sir. No, 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 sure, sir." There was something I didn't get. There was some subtlety there. It was totally eluding me. But so that was an interesting thing, you know. And obviously, when we were a little older, you know, and going to folk clubs, we heard lots of traditional music from all over the British Isles. You know, wonderful singers like the Watersons, Martin Carthy, singing these songs that are really part of our heritage.
And I do want to get to some of your songs, but you also write, as a kid, you were very shy. You also said you had a stutter. Was a music a way of dealing with some of that?
I think it was, yeah. I think music gave me some self-esteem. And getting up on a stage, you know, probably from starting about the age of 12, gave me a bit more self-confidence. And it took me a while. It took me at least 10 years before I got really confident and shook my shyness off. But music was really the thing that helped a great deal. That helped me to really look at myself and say, well, you know, you're a better person than you think you are.
I mean, it sounded like, especially with your stutter, was that you sort of felt that you were afraid of your father, and that was sort of your way of perhaps dealing with it?
Yeah, maybe. I think the origins of that kind of thing aren't always clear. Yeah. But possibly, you know, fear of my father would be a probable cause, yeah.
You wanted a guitar from the age of 6 and had a series of sort of rebuilt guitars. It sounds like you had to kind of fight in the house to get your hands on it. When did you get the guitar that you really feel like launched your career?
Launched my career? Well, a bit later than that. I mean, I had a reasonable guitar probably when I was about 11 years old, and I took classical guitar lessons on an acoustic guitar. And I got an electric guitar about the same time, and maybe a year later. So probably when I was 11 or 12, I got an electric as well. And I used that guitar right until I was about 18 years old, or when I think I finally got a Gibson, you know, like a real guitar. And then went through a succession of you know, Gibsons, Fenders, various things. Tools of the trade.
Didn't sound like, though, you got a lot of encouragement. I think one of your schools said you were a musical no-hoper. That's maybe a very British word. I wasn't aware of that word, no-hoper.
It's a good word, isn't it?
It is a good word.
Yeah. Well, it's that thing of if you begin learning music by ear, sometimes that's always the easiest and the quickest way for you, rather than to look at the musical notation on a page. And so when I started music lessons at school, I really didn't understand what was going on. I couldn't equate what I was learning at school with what I already knew as a guitar player. So I did very badly in music at school. But then when I took classical lessons, that turned around a bit, and I began to get a bit more understanding of the written note. And slowly, I became able to read music. And but still, I mean, to this day, I'm quicker by ear. And I think that's just a thing that happens. It depends which one you start out with.
I like the way you write about my life at the age of 18 consisted of equal parts frustration and joy, frustration of being stuck in a suburban wasteland with my parents and school. So much of my pleasure and self-esteem came from music and art, and I longed for a life where I could devote my time to them. And you go on from there, and it's just a lovely passage about this moment in your life when, I guess maybe looking back, your musical life really begins.
I think in the real sense, yes, it does. I think freedom begins about there. You finally get away from your parents, and you get to hang out with the people you want to hang out with. Musically, that was the beginning of a sort of a long upward incline as we slowly got better as a band, practiced more, started playing a lot more shows in 1967. We kind of formed at a great time because there was so much work available. There were so many places to play. There was so much demand for bands that we were almost instantly working 4 or 5 nights a week. Huh. And we were lucky to be riding this kind of psychedelic wave, you know, in behind, you know, Pink Floyd and the Soft Machine and these London psychedelic bands. We weren't psychedelic remotely, but we were able to kind of coast in on that wave as it took shape and as it confused the music industry.
Well, I want to pick up on all of that, and we're going to play some of your music. Richard Thompson is our guest, one of the founders of Fairport Convention. He's got a brand new memoir. It's called Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. We got a little taste of his early life. We're going to be talking more about his life on the road and as a musician, and we've already got lots of people that want to join our conversation. I'm not surprised. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscoane, talking with Richard Thompson, one of the founders of Fairport Convention. Time Will Show the Wiser from Fairport Convention's self-titled debut album from 1968.
Best friend of mine, but I know that I need someone to hold, to love,
And time will show the wiser from Fairport Convention's self-titled debut album. And to you, Richard Thompson, what was the thinking? What was the thinking behind the creation of that sound that we associate with Fairport Convention?
Well, it was a slowly evolving thing. I think that particular record that you just sampled from, we were really finding our feet, and the record is all over the place in terms of influences, in terms of sound. And I think the next record, what we established more the kind of sound that we were looking for, which is kind of a British folk rock, really. I think that's the way you describe it.
And we will get to that. One of the things I wanted to ask you, I mean, in this country, we talk about the British invasion of, you know, the British bands coming to America. And I'm assuming in England for you, you talk about Love and Spoonful and the Birds and some of these other American groups that you really liked a lot.
We did, you know. I think Fairport were always a lyric band and we were always a roots band. And so when we were still taking our inspiration from America, we love people like the Birds, who were doing songs like The Bells of Rhymney, and Turn, Turn, Turn. Yeah, you know, these songs that, you know, came from really Pete Seeger. We love their rootsiness. And the same, the Loving Spoonful were taking influences from, you know, everywhere, Howlin' Wolf and country music, Nashville music. So we really appreciated that. And also from a band like the Birds, we thought, well, we can find a kind of direction ourselves from their example.
You write that at that time you thought the Beatles were just a pop band.
Well, it's true. We loved the Beatles in one sense, you know, and the Stones. But we thought they were kind of an older generation, and we were far more interested, if you like, in the new Phil Oakes record or the new Tim Hardin record than we were in the new Beatles record. I mean, they were very snobby, you know, extremely snobby people that we were.
Weren't we all back then?
Well, we were, for sure.
Yeah. Well, let me play Tamlin. This is from Fairport Convention's 1969 album, Leech and Leaf, and this is featuring Sandy Denny, who I do want to talk with you about, but let's just play. It's a little bit more than a minute. Let's give that a listen. From Fairport Convention's 1969 album, Leech and Leaf, and that's featuring Sandy Denny and Richard Thompson. I just love that song so much. I love the way the instruments sort of punctuate her voice.
It's a song that would have been always sung unaccompanied, really. It comes from southern Scotland, I think. Carter Hoare is somewhere near the Scottish border. And you know, it's a song about, you know, fairies, basically. It's about the supernatural, of which there are a lot of songs in Great Britain for some reason. And the song is certainly 18th century, could be older than that. Yeah. Probably older than that, in fact. Fairport would try to take a song like that and to arrange it in a more modern way. And this was one of the ways that we thought to do it. And it's in 5/4, you know, first of all, which is an unusual kind of way to deal with it. But sometimes when solo traditional singers sing, it's very hard to tell what time signature they're actually singing in. So 5/4 gave us a bit more leeway with the kind of vagaries of the meter of the song. And the accents are really just to give it some drama, give the song some punch. in a more, contemporary way.
Well, I love that song so much. And of course, featuring Sandy Denny, as you write, Sandy was an extraordinary bundle of contradictions. She thought of herself not thin or tall enough. And yet when men went nuts for her, she always wanted the ones who resisted her. She was both very sure of herself musically and then not so sure. And you were never quite certain which Sandy you were dealing with. Help us understand. I think we can hear what she brings to the music, but what it was like working with her.
The minute that we heard Sandy, or when she came to an audition, we just thought, well, that's it. You know, yeah. She's absolutely. You couldn't ask for more in a singer, and it turned out a songwriter. She was a fantastic singer. I don't think I've ever worked with a better singer. She could do everything. She had an incredible range. She could go from a whisper to a scream, and she was a great emotional interpreter of any song, to the point where she owns songs the way Frank Sinatra or someone would own a song. Sandy owned the songs that she sang. Other people could try to do a version, but it would never be as good as Sandy's. So she was really musically just absolutely brilliant.
You write that she lacked a layer of skin.
Well, she did. She was hypersensitive, and it could be very easily upset or could be roaring with laughter the next minute. I mean, she was very changeable in her personality and in some ways difficult to deal with. But when I think of Sandy, I like to think of the good times, the times when she's like making everybody just crack up with laughter.
Caleb has a question for you. Does Richard still have the guitars he used in early Fairport Convention stuff?
I don't really. I had a big Jazz Gibson, a Gibson 175, that when I got a Les Paul, I handed that over to Simon, and then Simon used it for a few years, and then he traded it in on something else. I don't have my old Hofner guitar. I gave that to somebody, a friend of mine, and then he handed it on to his nephew, who might still have it. Guitars come and guitars go. For a long time, I could not afford two guitars. I had to sell the one to get the new one. So it took until about the 80s before I could seriously start collecting a few more. So I'm very sad. I'd love to have all my old guitars back and my old amps as well, actually.
we'll send out a call and see if we can help you out with that.
Yeah.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Richard Thompson, and he's one of the founders of Fairport Convention. We've been playing some of his music, and he's just written a memoir. It's called Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. Here's a question from Barry. He says, one of the most distinctive things about Richard's guitar playing is the tone. It's clean yet piercing at the same time. What is it about this sound that Richard found so compelling, and where did the inspiration come from?
The inspiration came from probably the guy who engineered a lot of Fairport's early records, John Wood, a wonderful, wonderful engineer. And he said, your tone is either too trebly or it's too dark, but you want something that's more in the middle. And he played me some examples of other guitar players. And I thought, well, how can I get something that will sit into the mix of a record better? And I started to explore the out of phase sounds on Fender. And I probably started doing that in about 1968, 69, when I switched over from Gibson's. This is all very technical. I'm sure I'm boring 99% of the audience.
Not our listeners. I don't think so. They're fans.
To answer your question, it's basically an out of phase sound.
Sure. I hear you. You tell a wonderful story. This is September 1968. You're playing at the Festival of Contemporary Song, and a young Joni Mitchell is performing there as well. She's just, starting her career. And you snuck backstage and took a look at her notebook. First of all, why did you want to do that, and what did you see?
Well, it was a spur of the moment thing, the dressing room door was open, the book was kind of lying there, and I thought, well, I'll just have a little look. And I'd compare it to probably Sandy's notebook, which I saw frequently, where there's kind of she's writing out verses of a song, but also doing these incredible doodles and kind of cartoons and stuff all around the edge. And Joni's was a bit like that, it was like a very artistic human being, expressing herself. I'm a bit embarrassed by this incident at this point in my life, but there you
Really?
go.
I mean, just because you kind of looked in one of her private things?
It's a private thing. I'd sort of
Sure.
hate it if someone did it to me, so I'm quite sorry I did it to her.
I'm curious about your notebooks. I mean, what do your notebooks look like?
Similar. Well, I'm very fussy about notebooks. I have to use French stationery, which means tragically I have to go to Paris every couple of years to stock up on notebooks. How terrible is that? So it's a real fetish thing with me. It has to be the right pens, it has to be the right paper, the right notebooks. It's a whole business. And I do doodle a bit as well. It's perhaps part of the creative process.
What is it about French paper that you like so much?
Ooh, it's what's the English word? Quadrille. What do you call it? It's like graph lines, like a cross-hatched, whatever you call it. I mean squares, little squares, and you can also lay it flat, so you've got two pages open at a time, so you can write tangentially rather than logically. You can go off to the side and write something sideways and backwards, and I like a bit of space, a bit of an area to write on.
So obviously not composing or writing on a computer or anything like that.
More and more I write on computer, but the first draft is always, notebook, probably the first two or three drafts, and then I'll go to computer.
Well, you are listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Richard Thompson about his musical career, and he's got a new memoir. It's called Bee's Wing. And again, you are listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. You do write about this really traumatic event in your life. This is a car crash. You're with your band. It's been a long night. You were performing, coming home. The driver at the wheel of the car falls asleep, and tragically, your girlfriend at the time was killed. Your drummer at the time was killed as well. And you write almost in like slow-mo sort of detail about being in the car and seeing what's happening and sort of being in the accident, but also sort of looking down and being outside of the accident. That must have been a tough thing to write about.
Yeah, it was very hard to write about. It was even harder to do the audiobook, which I just finished. It was difficult. Not something that I like to go into in detail on a daily basis. So, I had to kind of, dig a bit, revive old memories of what happened. And I really just tried to describe exactly what happened with fairly unemotionally, if I could, to get through it. Now, and sometimes I had to pretend I was writing about somebody else. I was just telling a story. But it was a very traumatic event that affected us very deeply. I think it took a couple of years really to get over that. We didn't have people saying, oh, you must go to therapy. You have to get over this. That just wasn't the style in those days. They just said, well, tough up and chin up and get on with life, basically. So I don't think we ever, grieved properly. I think the effects were that, the band personnel changed quite a lot, and it took us a couple of years really to get over the shock, I think.
Did it help you to write about it, though? I mean, I realize these are very painful memories, but did it help you grieve at all to be able to write about it?
I think it helped a bit. And over the years, I've talked to the other band members about the accident, and we kind of had a bit of a grieve together in that sense. I wanted to write fairly accurately about it for the sake of the families of Martin and Jeannie, who probably didn't know all the details about the crash.
You also write at that time, you're on the road, and it sounds like most of the time you're absolutely bitter, freezing cold. True?
Well, certainly the first year, probably the first 2 winters we were on the road, I never seemed to get warm. Everything was freezing. There was a hole in the floor of the van that we used, so that was freezing. dressing rooms were never heated for some reason. That they just didn't think about things like that. And hotels were never heated. So you just jumped into bed with your clothes on, basically,
Wow.
and that was it, where to stay warm. That's my abiding memory of the winters of 68 and 69.
Here's a question from Julian. What does Richard Thompson think of the current trend of auto-tuned music, especially because he's covered pop singers like Britney Spears? Auto-tune.
Also tune. It's if someone did it once, I would think, well, that's quite interesting. The fact that it's become, like a standard, that everybody does it, and you get that kind of sound, that auto-tune sound, on everything. It's a bit unimaginative, I think. I have a problem with, with loops of music. I have a problem with, drum machines. I have a problem with the texture of music. If a drummer playing live hits a snare drum, every time he hits the snare drum in a song, it sounds different. It's a little bit different. Every time he hits the bass drum, it's a little bit different. If you just have a drum loop, it's the same every time, and my ears get tired, because it's just not refreshing enough as music. So, I tend to prefer people who play live, who record live, alt country or something. Grunge, garage, whatever you want to call it, rather than people who kind of make music, with machines.
Yeah. Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Richard Thompson is our guest, one of the founding members of Fairport Convention. He's had a long career in music, something like 55 years and probably counting. And he's also got a new memoir. It's called Bee's Wing: Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and if you are just joining us, I'm talking with acclaimed singer, songwriter, guitarist Richard Thompson. His memoir, Bee's Wing: Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, is about his early years growing up in England, his folk rock band, Fairport Convention, Sufism, which we will talk about, and much, much more. Let me play another piece of music. This is Walk a While from Fairport Convention's 1970 album, Full House. Again, Walk a While from Fairport Convention's 1970 album, Full House. You can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. If you have any questions for Richard Thompson, you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Richard, you write about you can write a new song, but you really do not know if it's good until you perform it in front of an audience. Why? Because until they hear it, it isn't done.
I think it's not so much whether a song is good. I think it's whether a song communicates.
Right.
So you can have a really good song, but if people don't get it, if nothing comes across, then you can sing it to yourself in the bath or something, but it isn't ever going to be something that other people will enjoy. So, the test of a record that may be the test of a song you may be going to put on a record, you would go and play it live and see if it does that thing, if it gets across to people.
Well, at that time, and you know, what's I think so wonderful about that time is you describe England or London, certainly in the 60s and even into the 70s, as this sort of music mecca, fashion, youth culture. I mean, we have a version of this going on today around the world, but to be in the thick of that must have been quite exciting.
Well, it was extraordinary, you know, to be in London during the 60s especially. And, you know, Fairport were a little bit younger than, you know, the Beatles, the Stones, the Kinks, who were, you know, 5 years at least our seniors. So we weren't at that particular epicenter, but we were kind of on the next wave, you know, the sort of the Pink Floyd wave that came in 67 onwards. And, you know, London really was a center, the center of fashion, center of music for sure, and a center of art as well, really. So just great to be there at that time.
And how different was it performing in England and performing in the United States?
I think in England we had a fairly loyal audience, mostly in London, but then it started to spread out into the provinces. There were certain parts of the UK which were very partisan and would never really accept you unless you came from there, like Glasgow, famously. Newcastle used to be a bit like that as well. So it was kind of bitty in the UK, but if you had your following, you were fine. Touring America is very much of a kind of mixed bag. And we started out playing in clubs like the LA Troubadour and playing the Fillmores. And, you know, it was just a very laid-back audience. So what can I say? And perhaps they were laid-back for everybody just because people, you know, were smoking and you know, feeling particularly relaxed, I suppose, in the audience, that they were actually absorbing it but not showing much reaction.
Is that hard to perform for people who are so stoned and not reacting to the music?
It's always nice to get a reaction from the audience, even if it's hostile. You know, at least you know that you're getting something across. So I think the answer is yes.
And did you get hostility? Were there hostile audiences to you and your music?
Not so much in America. It was more, you know, the worst reaction we had was probably indifference. As opposed to actual hostility. We had hostility in the UK. And, you know, when I was a teenager, I faced some really hostile audiences where they're, you know, they're throwing stuff, you know, throwing chairs at the stage and that kind of stuff, where you're in fear of your life. You know, there's fights breaking out in the audience. I'm sure most musicians have been through that particular phase.
Is it because they didn't think you were good enough or they didn't know who the heck you were?
No, it's just, you know, it's Friday night, it's Saturday night. People have a few drinks. They get into fights. What's happening on the dance floor is more interesting than the people playing the music. You know, it's just life.
We do want to play Calvary Cross, and this is Richard Thompson, and your then wife, Linda Thompson. This is from 1974 album, I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight. Before we play that, though, you did fire Sandy Denny, and you did hire Linda Thompson. You married her. What did she bring to the music that you were looking for?
Linda has a very pure voice. It's a different kind of emotion to Sandy's. You know, so Sandy, you hear, you know, the vibrato and you know, that kind of, you know, intense emotion. Where Linda's a little bit cooler, but incredibly direct. She just points directly at your heart. Just a whole different approach, really. But, you know, Sandy and Linda were great friends and, you know, used to hang out together for years and perhaps they learned things from each other. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, let's listen. This is Calvary Cross from Richard and Linda Thompson's 1974 album, I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight.
I was under the Calvary Cross. On your shoes.
Calvary Cross. Richard Thompson, John Ahrens is one of the producers of Radio Times, just sent us a message. I have to hold back tears every time I hear Calvary Cross, and it's such a powerful song. Can you speak to that?
Can I speak to it? Well, I suppose for me, it's a song about music. It's about the muse, if you like, you know, what music does to you, how music, in one sense, enslaves you. It makes you a slave to the creative urge. Many people have expressed this before in different ways, but for me, that's the nature of the song. It's also a song that doesn't rhyme, which is kind of curious. It's a lot of it's all half rhymes, and there's not many songs that I've ever done like that.
Lawrence has a question. Did Richard use the bagpipes as an inspiration for his guitar playing? I'm thinking of the introduction to Calvary Cross.
I grew up listening to the bagpipes. Some of my earliest musical memories are the Scottish pipes. I would say that the introduction to Calvary Cross is probably much more inspired by Irish piping, particularly Willie Clancy. I had a Willie Clancy record when I was a teenager and just loved that. And I love the kind of similarity in the kind of bends that you have on the Irish pipes. You know, as a guitar player, you bend notes in the blues or in country music. And here was this Irish piper doing kind of the same thing, but bending other kinds of intervals, bending, you know, different sorts of notes that were kind of outside of the usual scale, in a sense.
Maureen had a question. Is the wall of death in the song referring to a roller coaster, a motorcycle ride, or something else entirely?
Well, it's a motorcycle thing. I think they had them in America as well, certainly in sort of 1930s, 1940s. In the UK, it was this bowl-shaped arena, and a motorcycle would go around this bowl, going faster and faster until it was vertical. And there was a famous one in the UK which had a sidecar, and in the sidecar they had a lion.
Oh, wow. An actual lion.
and the lion is sitting in the sidecar as it's whizzing around this thing at God knows how fast. And the lion seemed to be quite enjoying itself. So, that was pretty bizarre.
Let me ask you about Sufism, which you write quite a bit about, especially near the end of your memoir. You're a young man, and you discover it or you find it. What drew you to Sufism?
I did a lot of exploration, you know, of various spiritual paths. You know, from about the age of 15, 16, I got interested in things like Zen, Buddhism, and I started to read a lot. You know, I'd read my way through, you know, all the spiritual paths. And I kind of paused at the Sufis, and I thought, well, this is interesting. These people seem to have something that I need, you know, that I want in my life. And almost as I'm framing that thought, they almost literally turn up on my doorstep. Huh. And so, you know, I became associated with them. I'm still associated with them. And it's something that answers a lot of my needs.
Yeah. But you do write about trying to, and you're young, you're in your 20s, but trying the struggle, I don't know, maybe that's too strong a word, of sort of reconciling your musical life and your spiritual life. Have you reconciled that as a 70, yeah, what, 2-year-old, whatever you are?
Yeah, something like that. I suppose so. Yeah, I think because of when I went into Sufism, there's a whole musical tradition in there that comes from North Africa. So I was very influenced for a while by North African music, and I had a hard time reconciling that with the music that I knew, which was mostly kind of, you know, Western rock and roll and Celtic music. But finally, I put the bits together. It didn't take too long, actually, but it was kind of a bit of a dichotomy for a while.
Cletus asks, how did Richard get the inspiration for the Vincent Black motorcycle song?
I think I consider American songwriters very lucky in that so many things that you can write about in America, you know, just the names of states or towns sometimes, the name of cars, you know, can have instant romantic resonance. You know, and I thought, wouldn't it be nice if that happened in the UK? But it really doesn't. We don't have that songwriting tradition We don't have that romantic tradition. So I was trying to think of objects that would have the same kind of resonance as a Cadillac or something in America. And I thought the Vincent motorcycle, which is this beautiful, very rare object, would be a great thing to set a song around. So that was really the origin of the idea.
And that is Richard Thompson, one of the founders of Fairport Convention, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Your memoir is titled Bee's Wing, and that is, you know, one of your most famous songs, I should say. And you write quite a bit about the writing of the song in this memoir. Help us understand, and we're going to close with just about a minute and a half or so of the song, but help us understand the inspiration for it.
For the song Bee's Wing. It's... I suppose a retrospective look at the 60s and 70s and some of the aspects of that time. And when I was at school, lots of kids did not take the road well traveled. They did not go to university. They did not go into the family business. They dropped out. They became, you know, drug dealers, drug casualties in some cases. They lived on communes. They really wanted an alternative lifestyle and some alternative meaning to their lives. So I thought that that song in many ways encapsulates those ideas. And it talks about people who voluntarily and involuntarily drop out of society, that they drop through the safety net of society and find themselves on the road. And it's a kind of a bittersweet song, really. It's an unrequited love song.
Yeah. And just a quick question before we have to say goodbye. Are you ready to go on the road we're not quite post-pandemic, but we're getting there.
Yes. Let me go on the road, please, please, please.
Do you feel like your wings have been clipped?
Oh, my God. It's been a tough, you know, year. It's going to be a tough sort of 16 months. But finally, the dates are coming in. There'll be some live stuff over the summer, some outdoor stuff. And then I'm being booked into theaters the fall onwards. So hallelujah. Hooray.
Hallelujah. Richard Thompson, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And his memoir titled Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. And the show was produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. And we do want to close things out with Bee's Wing. This is an acoustic version of Richard Thompson's song from the 2014 album Acoustic Classics.
I was 19 when I came to town, the cut of the summer of love. There were burning babies, burning flax, the hawks against the doors. I took a job in the steamy down on Cardin Street, and I fell in love with a laundry girl who was working next to me. Well, she was a rare thing, fine as a bee's wing, so fine a breath of wind might blow her away. She was a lost child, well, she was running wild. She said, as long as there's no price in love, I'll stay. And you wouldn't want me any other way.